Committee will come to order. Good morning. This is the Customer Service and Operations Committee meeting for November 4th, 2010. The agenda's been previously distributed. Are there any changes? Actually, there has been a change. Mr. Kubitschek, I know that there's an item. I'm sorry, Mr. Kubitschek, are you ready?
Yes, sir.
I know that there's an item not on this agenda that was to have been on it.
The LaFont?
Yes.
There was a change to the agenda, was there not, from that which I approved previously?
The LaFont, we were told that we would verbally talk about that today.
Yes, I actually had something different in mind.
The 1K?
Yeah.
I did leave you a message last night
about
that.
But other people weren't privy to that, and that wasn't the agenda that I approved. We will make one change to the agenda. There will be an initial information item relating to LaFont escalators. With that, does anyone else have any other changes? If not, assume the agenda is accepted as presented. The minutes of the September 16th and October 14th meetings have been presented. Does anybody have a chance to review them? Are there any changes, questions, requests for amendation? Sorry?
I move both.
Second.
Moved and seconded to approve both as presented. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The minutes are accepted as presented. First information item, Mr. Sarles.
Yes. I'd like to give the board committee an update on the escalator incident at LaFont Plaza last weekend. We have not concluded our investigation of that, so this will be an update of where we are in the investigation, what has been found so far. We've interviewed witnesses. We've downloaded some information from the controller of the escalator. We're also bringing in the independent consultant we've used before to provide us advice and help us in the investigation. And ultimately, we will not return the escalator to service until we are satisfied we know the cause and that has been inspected by the district. I'd like to turn over to Bob Manusco, who will give you the details of what we've seen thus far.
Hi, my name is Robert Manusco. I'm with SAFE, Mr. Daugherty's office. Preliminary report.
Let's not use code. So, I'm sorry, the name of your office is?
Safety.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I love the acronyms here.
Yeah, we do at Metro.
Yes. Preliminary report of the LaFont escalator. As everybody knows, on Saturday, October 30th at approximately 2:07 p.m. in the afternoon, escalator 2 located at 9th and D Street entrance of LaFont Plaza Station accelerated after a distinct sound of a metallic bang. The individuals riding the escalator began running off the escalator at the bottom. As the speed increased, some riders fell. This caused a pileup at the bottom of the escalator. Emergency response was initiated by MTPD officers. DC Fire Department medics responded at approximately 2:17 p.m. 6 individuals were injured, 4 transported to area hospitals, 2 reported injuries but refused medical treatment. One of the injuries is reported to be serious with a severe laceration and possible internal injuries. None of the injuries are considered to be life-threatening. The escalator is currently out of service pending a WMATA elevator escalator department internal investigation. While the investigation continues, preliminary findings have been determined based on the information from the ELIS, or Elevator Escalator Group staff, interviews conducted with 10 individuals that were either on the escalator or witnessed the incident, and additional statements obtained from MTPD from 4 additional individuals. The findings that we have to date, the unit involved was escalator number 2. It is unit D03W02. The escalator is a Westinghouse Modular 100 with an Allen-Bradley programmable logic controller to be used as PLC through the rest of my presentation. The escalator had previously been running in the ascending direction prior to the incident. The station manager stopped the escalator and reversed it to a descending escalator. That is due to the crowding in the area. Our normal escalator speed here at WMATA is 90 feet per minute. There was very heavy loading on the escalator due to the Restore Sanity rally. Escalator motors stopped due to an overspeed fault. This fault triggers at a 10% increase of normal escalator speed. When the escalator's motor shut down, the brakes engaged. However, they failed to hold back the escalator due to the passenger load on the escalator. The escalator increased speed. As the passengers departed the escalator slowed, eventually stopping approximately 18 seconds after the overspeed fault shut down the motors. There are three motors on this escalator. Each motor has a brake. When an examination was made, one brake was found to have oil on it from a leaking motor housing. One brake showed brake pad wear. The third brake's pads were looked at and found to be in good condition. The escalator was originally installed July 1st, 1977. It was rehabilitated between February 11th, 04 and May 10th, 04 by Jones Vertran. The last scheduled maintenance was performed September 28, 2010, and this was deemed a scheduled quarterly inspection at that time. The escalator control unit has been opened up, and the event log from the controller has been recorded. Alan Bradley was contacted and were on site yesterday, 11-3, to assist with data retrieval from the PLC. Vertical Transportation Excellence, known as VTX, has been contacted to independently verify the findings of WMATA's internal response team. This is an active investigation being performed at this time, and it is still under investigation. The escalator has been taken out of service pending that investigation, and prior to the return of service, the unit must be inspected by DC.
By the district building inspector.
Yes.
Thank you. Let me make sure I understood one thing that you said. Do I understand basically that you're saying the brakes failed and the weight of those on the escalator caused it to go into essentially free fall for a while?
Because once the motors actually stopped due to a fault that was sensed, that fault that was sensed was overspeed. So as the load of the people got on, the escalator actually sensed that. The brakes actually applied, so the pieces that should have worked did work, except for the brake failure, which now has been broken down into the two areas that I told you, the oil on the one brake shoes and the other worn brake pads on the other one.
So, and then recognizing this is an ongoing investigation and this is a preliminary report, you're saying it's not that you think that the mechanism caused something to accelerate, but that the volume of passengers caused it to speed up and then the brakes failed?
No, I'm saying that the brakes failed. That was the mechanism. And the load, it did not hold back the load.
Okay, that's what I was trying to say.
I don't know if I'm understanding your question correctly, but no.
Yeah, the motor didn't speed up or something. It's the weight of passengers.
It was basically gravity. I heard it three or four times, gravity. Yeah.
So. And then the brakes failing meant it just went.
That's correct.
Okay. Mr. Jinkley.
Yeah, the September 2010 inspection, which you noted in your briefing, was there anything noted on that inspection of things to be concerned about with that escalator? And, in fact, who conducted that inspection? Was it in-house forces or was it contract forces?
It was in-house forces, and we're currently going through all the documentation at this time, what was noted during that inspection.
Yeah, what concerns me is if they had oil on one of the motors and the brake pads were suspicious. Hopefully those appeared on the inspection report.
I have been told that brakes are looked at during those quarterly inspections as part of that quarterly inspection. So that should have been one of the items, and we are pulling the paper records.
Mr. Grant.
And what was the speed that this escalator eventually went to?
It lasted 18 seconds from start to finish. What the actual speed was, I can't determine. I spoke to somebody who's been reaching out to you. The gentleman said it was the fastest he's ever seen. That doesn't tell me a lot. So without a quantitative number.
But the normal speed would be
90 feet per minute.
Per minute. And so for 18 seconds, that accelerated very substantially.
As the load decreased, it actually slowed. So as the load, the force is bringing it down as they spewed, spilled out on the bottom of this and the load decreased, it slowed.
Was the problem resolved by the fact that people stopped getting on the escalator?
Well, that happened up at the top, which right. I've heard people up there stopped, and we also, MTPD officers were up at the top as well. Yes.
So that really solved the immediate issue. People just simply stopped getting on the escalator.
Thank you. Question from Mr. Hewlett.
All right. Thank you. You described the unit brand and the motor type. Do we have any idea how many exact configurations like that we have in our system that have the same motor type and the same brand escalator unit?
I'd have to follow up to give you the specifics. We do have a lot of, Westinghouse units in our system, but we'd have to provide an actual breakdown exact.
Yeah, because I would hope after an incident like this, we would take a look at that and perhaps do an inspection of each of those other units in the system just to give a look and make sure we don't have similar characteristics that are in existence. Is that being done?
Yes, sir. As part of the VTX report, when we were looking at that, we'd already initiated a campaign where we were checking all of the single motor, single brake escalators throughout the entire system. And so with this coming on board, absolutely, we'll be going through every escalator, regardless of its brand type, but we will prioritize the specific, model.
Thank you.
Mr. Babb.
Just following up on, I was going to ask that same question, have it answered. But following up on Mr. Zimmerman's question about cause and effect, what I'm assuming I'm hearing is the escalator was overloaded, which caused the overspeed, which caused the motors to stop, and then the brakes didn't kick in. Because this happened first when an overspeed was noted in the motors.
The brakes did kick in.
The brakes did
they
kick in.
They failed to hold it back.
Didn't do their
correct
job. But backing up to first cause, it was excess loading making the motors overspeed, or was it?
I would hesitate to use the word excess loading until the investigation is completed. What we hear, what I've heard, and as you heard, that with the loading on there, the escalator started to speed up, and then the safety went on, and it should have stopped it. But I would be hesitant to characterize it as excess loading at this point.
Do we have a history of this type of accident, or are there records of this specific type of failure occurring previously?
It's part of what we're looking into because we do need to look at the specific model compared to other incidents that have happened in the country that might be related to this, but it would not be proper for me to say something like that without having the facts.
Okay. You don't know yet. Okay. Clearly there was a heavy load on the system at that time, as there are, not infrequently. So while, and there's a physical limit to how many people can get on an escalator just because of the space. So it sounds like there was heavy loading. I don't know that we could make a statement about excessive loading or too loading, because presumably that's what was riding all the other escalators too, that did not happen to fail on that day. Any idea of the time frame when you'll have more information?
Alan Bradley, I know, was there yesterday. We're waiting on a report from them.
Alan Bradley, who really is the equipment manufacturer of the controls itself, they were here. So they were able to download all of the information in that. At this time, we've got VTX that's also involved. We're also putting together like a test plan, because even after we go through and we find various findings, there would be some simulations and stuff that we would like to conduct to help validate, the failures and the theories of that. So you're looking at least a couple of weeks before We would maybe have information that every day somebody's working on it, so we're finding out, you know, different materials and such. But that's kind of the path and the action going forward. But I would look for something substantial, you know, within the next couple of weeks.
Okay.
Yeah. So we'll give an update at the safety committee. Just based on what Dave was saying, I just don't know if we'll be at the conclusion at that point, but certainly an update.
Very good. Any additional questions? No. Thank you very much for this very thorough and clear report. All right, we'll go to the regular agenda items now, starting with item 3A, which is the vital signs report. Will Ms. Burnside be presenting this?
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning. Can you go to the first slide? Since introducing the first vital signs report in June of this year, we've been presenting to this committee monthly. And this month, we continue to focus on performance by providing an in-depth review, a deeper dive, if you will, into one key aspect of Metro's operation, and that would be bus operations. Joining me in making the presentation are our subject matter experts, Mr. Jack Requa, Assistant General Manager for Bus, and Ted Harris, General Superintendent, Bus Transportation. A benefit of the vital signs report, as you know, is that it gives us an opportunity to detail the specific reasons monthly why performance is changing and the actions we're taking to improve performance. So in keeping with this, today's in-depth review includes information on what's working well, what's not working well and why, and what actions we're taking to improve performance. The next regular vital signs report will be presented at this committee's next meeting on December 2nd, and that basically covers the October data. And the report covering September's performance data that we normally would have presented today will be available online at the scorecard tab this time next week. And now I'll turn it over to Jack Requa.
Thank you, Andrea. First, just an overview of Metro Bus. First of all, we're it's the sixth largest bus system in the United States with over 1,500 buses. We carry over 405,000 passengers on an average weekday. Due to the actions of the board and funding of bus procurement, we're very pleased to have our fleet age down to the level we like it at about 7.2 years. We operate out of 9 operating facilities with the 10th under construction at DC Village. We operate over 50 million miles per year. And to note that diesel fuel dependence has dropped by 35% since the introduction of compressed natural gas in 2001 and the implementation of hybrid buses, which generate about a 1.5 mile per gallon improvement over the standard diesel bus. There are a lot of technologies that have come forth that we've been able to get more and more information to assist not only the customers in getting information, but help us manage the system. And Ted Harris, our acting general superintendent, is going to speak to an effort that he has undertaken in creating a dashboard within bus that kind of accumulates that information and is live information that can be used as a management tool on a daily basis. So, Ted, you summarize?
Okay, thanks, Jack. One of the things that we were faced with this past year was that we all get performance reports, and they all come at different times of the month, and they all are represented by different formats. Some are Excel, some are Word perfect documents or Word documents. What we've done in bus is used existing data systems, amalgamated them, and now we have a live reporting dashboard. This dashboard that you see highlights key performance indicators for bus. It deals with safety, it deals with financial issues, and it deals with customer service issues. So we're focused on those specific areas. This dashboard is updated every day at 9 a.m. So every divisional superintendent has this embedded on their computer. What this does is allows them to monitor their service on a daily basis and see where they're instance here, where they are with respect to on-time performance or safety conversations. It's a multi-layered dashboard. That means you can scroll with your mouse over any part of this dashboard and drill down into the statistics that support that. Now, this particular dashboard has been developed with the help of our IT folks and uses new technology, which is SharePoint. As I said, this is the first time we've ever been able to amalgamate all this information into a statistical database that we use on a daily basis. The benefit of this is A, it represents where we are on a daily basis. But more importantly, how do we use it? So what we set up is every Friday, how we exercise this is we review with our divisional superintendents. Then on the 15th of the month, much like a P&L statement, you go back and you review where you were and you forecast where you want to be at the end of the month to make sure you're still on target. And that's the biggest change that we're implementing in BUS is the use of information and making sure that you're meeting your targets as you go along. Next slide, please. This is one example. This is a bus safety conversation, time compliance. And this is an important keystone element of BUS right now. A safety conversation is a discussion between a supervisor and employee or an employee and a supervisor. An employee came up to me the other day and actually had a safety conversation with me. He saw that I got in my car and I didn't immediately put on my safety belt, so he reminded me that putting on your seat belt in a timely way is important. All these safety conversations are plotted, okay? We have different targets for our street supervisors, our management, but they're plotted on a monthly basis for both our maintenance employees and our bus employees. And we can see, for instance, let's say at the 15th of the month, if we're falling behind, we talk to our superintendents about getting the message out. So that's one layer of the safety conversations. It's one layer of the bus performance. And we can duplicate this multi-layered effect for both accidents that are coming from the SME system. We can duplicate it for our financial reports, and we can duplicate it for our on-time performance and our customer service. We're making some modifications to the overall dashboard that will allow us to drill into specific areas. Let's say delays. Delays on, we categorize all our delay complaints, and now we'll be able to drill down to specific routes.
Next slide. So key to maintaining an outstanding performance in bus operations
is... Back 1 second. We have a request for a clarification on the previous one. Mr. Gincola?
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand this chart. It says bus safety conversation dash time compliance. And I'm looking at that, and I'm, you know, unfortunately I read ahead,
right,
and I'm looking at the below 75% on-time performance. How do they relate, and what is this really telling me?
Well, this doesn't relate to on-time performance. It relates to the number of conversations that are happening on a monthly basis.
But what's the time compliance saying?
The time compliance is each group has a number of hours that they have to accomplish or get conducted each month. So in this particular case, in July, the groups didn't reach their target of, let's say, achieving 1 hour of safety conversations for that month. They were at around 60%, which would have been maybe 45 minutes of
right,
safety
so this
conversations.
All based on 1 hour of conversation on safety issues. Okay.
Correct.
All right, that makes more sense. I'm not sure I picked that up during.
Okay.
Okay, next slide. So, as I said, key to having an outstanding operation is to attract the best and brightest employees. They're really key. And so in 2009, we started looking at different tools available in the industry to select the best employees at the front end. And in December of 2009, we adopted what's called Select Advantage, and this is a behavioral assessment selection tool that is used to select bus operator candidates. The purpose of this tool is to identify candidates that possess key elements of a successful bus operator. And as an example, the assessment tool is made up of three sections. Section one really focuses on work interest and willingness. The questions revolve around detailed information about the applicant's values, culture, expectations of the work. The other section would look at critical work behaviors that will predict their performance on the job. And section three is an instrument that measures the effect of their work judgment on the job and prediction of performance on how the job is achieved. So the benefit of this has been a decreased turnover rate of students and an improved on-the-job performance.
Yes. On that one?
A question on that particular, can you go back? You've had it in place now for 10 months, roughly 10 months. Has it resulted in a longer period to recruit bus operators, or has you seen no change in the amount of time it takes to put someone on the, or to select someone?
I can't speak to the longer period, but what it does do is it requires a larger pool to select from. because not as many people will pass as did before. I don't know how it's impacted the
time. So out of 1,000 people, how many would pass before and now with the new system?
I'd have to ask HR to address that. Yeah. I mean, we can provide that information to you.
If I could just add to that, one thing it does do, and we've seen this, is that the quality of the individual out on the street, you're not getting as much turnover once they're employed, once they're in the field, and because they're able to understand the job and they have the innate ability to handle the stresses of the job.
Well, what I was getting at is if it's taking us longer to do this, that's probably one of the reasons why we have a backlog of getting people on board. So that's why I wanted to talk about that. Okay, thank you.
That's accurate.
What's the training period?
Approximately 4 weeks.
Four weeks.
Class starts every 4 weeks. Okay. It's an 8-week training period, though, for a bus operator. The next page is something we've reported frequently is bus fleet reliability, and obviously for customer service and quality of service, the fleet must be maintained and operate. Again, we just completed the replacement of 148 buses, new buses replacing old buses in the fleet. As a result of that, the mean distance between failures through September was 6,950, and at the end of October now we are over 7,000 miles between mean distance between failures. Part of the success, obviously, is getting the old buses off the street, getting the new buses on the street, but we've also enhanced our maintenance training program. What we've taken this from not as only procedures, training of the employees, of changing the oil and checking brakes and things like that are important, but how it relates to the entire operation of the bus, how it affects the customer, how it affects the on-time performance. So we're trying to integrate all of the employees into the total concept of what their activities in the shop do for the customer that's on the street.
Mr. Chair? Spencer. Going back that one slide, the target, how does that target for bus fleet reliability compare to other transit systems that operate in a somewhat similar atmosphere?
You know, Phil Wallace presented that to the committee 3 months ago. I believe that our numbers are, first of all, everybody measures it differently,
right.
Different criteria. But raw numbers would indicate, I think there was one other system that was in the area of 9,000. In fact, I think it was the MBTA, since I spent a few years there. If they haven't changed their practices, I might understand why they do that. But I think we're certainly in the top group. I think that, again, the consistent replacement of equipment and the support of capital equipment and tools and training have brought us to a fairly high level. But our goal is to always push that number up, and as long as the fleet replacement program, which is the key to it, I think we've shown in the past that the newer fleet is in the 8,000 to 10,000 miles between roll calls, and the older buses that are reaching the end of their life are closer to 4,000. So, the continuation of the replacement process, the training process, we hope to, stay in the 7,000 or above level.
And for a normal fleet distribution, you're saying 7,000 would be, and working in an urban environment similar to ours, 7,000 would be the kind of goal that most places would choose, or potentially something lower than that?
Well, I think experience, I mean, the numbers that we've seen would show numbers more likely lower. We're not really trying to compare to them. We're only trying to improve upon our own. But I think if we could have a one-to-one comparison, I think that we would come out very well.
I guess I'm trying to say, are we choosing a reasonable goal? And I think you're answering yes.
Well, we went from 6,000 last year to 6,700 this year. And since we're pushing 7, I'm sure that we're going to, with a reasonable winter, we will probably push the goal even higher next year.
Okay, good.
We've talked about things that are going well. And we're also going to talk about things that are not going that well. And on-time performance is a challenge. And again, in an area, the Washington area, we are running around 71% of on-time performance in 2010. Some of the things that are impacting that, workforce shortage, again, it's nice to have everybody in the ready room and ready to go every hour. I think we're missing very, very few trips as a result of workforce, but it becomes a challenge when we're 100 or 100 and more short on employees. We also mentioned not adhering to on-time pullout. We are working with our operators to make sure that they go through a check of the vehicle, a pre-trip inspection prior to it going out of the facility and getting to the end of the line so that it can start its trip on time. But we also have buses that are scheduled to come back during the middle of the day and turn around within 5 or 10 minutes and go back out. Now, if those buses don't come in on time due to congestion or other circumstances, that bus is late getting out, and we're trying to obviously work with our scheduling folks and our operations folks to try to do everything that we can to speed up or to improve upon on-time performance. I think we're reducing bus bunching, but one of the issues here is realistic run times. We've got a lot of construction in this area, and that causes a challenge, and we've got a number of locations, a lot of, I think, stimulus money that's been put into street improvements. I think we all want street improvements, but getting through the street improvement function itself makes it much of a challenge. Traffic congestion continues to grow. I think we're always listed as number two or number three in the country, and major events are, you know, certainly create detours and, you know, a Marine Corps marathon, Army marathon, activities on the mall always create a challenge to on-time performance. So we're working on a number of different areas, and you know, we continue to try to work with other groups, which we'll talk about in a second, as to some of the alternatives we have to try to improve on-time performance.
Mr. Equa, this I think there's a useful distinction here between the controllable and the uncontrollable. Right. But what's more useful, I think, is if you can attribute the actual delays to one or the other. So,
right.
For instance, in the chart on the right, we see that there's been a decline in performance relative to the year before, which you alluded
right.
to at the outset of your remarks. To what degree is that drop attributable to things in the first category versus those in the second? Have you tried to analyze it?
Well, I think we've attempted to analyze it from the standpoint. We know that there appears to be a significant level of higher level of construction in the area. You know, Pennsylvania Avenue, Lee Highway and Gallows, work on I-66 that would impact the 5A, Pennsylvania.
Right. Those are specific,
yeah, specific things.
Specific places that affect
right.
specific routes, so they're very identifiable.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The 5A was delayed 10 minutes on average all week long because
yeah.
of a tie-up at point X.
Right. Right.
So you can do that. Also, major events like what happened on Saturday
right.
obviously throws everything
off. It throws everything off.
Right.
Buses mm-hmm.
and probably shouldn't even be part of your regular
schedule. We should probably try to take that out if we can, but we don't.
But in order for this to be useful, I
right.
think you're going to need to know to what degree is this problem not adhering to on-time pullout, something you know which presumably you can directly address.
We do. We have numbers on that, and we're working primarily. We know we have some deficiencies in the morning of getting folks out the door immediately on time. We have a tracking device. We're improving upon that. We're putting more supervision in the yard to make sure that the buses get out and try to get to, you know, try and get to the end of the line so they can start their trip. Obviously, if you can start on time at the end of the trip, we have fairly good success in the morning and early hours in the morning peak. It degrades as the day goes along as congestion seems to build. So we know that we have more issues in the afternoon, which leads to the realistic run times. Do we have enough time to provide the service? You know, the challenge there is additional run time requires additional either buses or operator time, which requires funding. And that, you know, is a challenge in the ways that we try to keep the budget balanced and try to keep the same level of service on the street. So it's a balancing act that, you know, we're probably behind as congestion develops, being able to adjust our run times from a financial standpoint to try to make things more realistic.
Okay, but, I mean, I think that's just the kind of thing we need to know.
Okay.
Because if what's preventing you from getting a more reliable service
right.
is a specific dollar amount you don't have,
mm-hmm.
that's a really good thing to know. If the result of your not having it is we run less reliable service and fewer people ride, which leads us to the conclusion that maybe this isn't a viable route and the
right.
farebox recovery rate is low, I guess we ought to cut it.
Okay.
Then, you know, that's the kind of thing we
sure.
ought to be thinking about ahead of time. And a lot of times that kind of information doesn't actually
okay.
reach the public.
Well, we're, as part of the FY12 budget process, we're going to ensure that we bring forth some realistic numbers of improvements that we could make if the funding was available that would and directly affect, and our major concern is to affect on-time performance to give a reliable product to the customer.
Mr. Giancola.
Bus operator availability. Now, right now we have, 1,500 or so active buses, you said?
Yes.
And how many operators do we have in our system right now?
2,400.
So those 2,400 are spread among those buses.
Right.
And
nine facilities and over the 7 days
a week. And how many vacant?
About 100 and
do you have now?
About 104 this week. It goes up and down. It fluctuates based on absenteeism rates. But
well,
this
what, 5-6%?
Right.
Right.
Is that normal nationwide? That's, I'm going to ask a normalization, or actually a benchmarking question. Is that a good number nationally? And secondly, you know, availability is also variable. In other words, people get sick. They won't be out, right, able to operate. And have we kind of looked at that as a as an element of our concern as well, or have you benchmarked it and we seem to be falling into some national parameters where it's okay?
Well, I don't know that I can answer number one as to how we compare with others, but in the 2400, there's an extra board that is available to us for the events of sickness and, you know, operators not available. We have runs that require for vacation relief, so we know that so many people are going to be on vacation, so we have people to work that. Ideally, you know, or ideally we'd like to have no vacancies. We think about 50 is a number that we can work with. So our goal is to try to get down to about 50 vacancies, but we're at 100, 104. The gentleman to my right has a lot of vacancies.
104
this week.
Well, I got the impression last week when we, unfortunately, you know, we disapproved mm-hmm. the request for a mm-hmm. contract acceleration of the HR
right.
a budget to get it. But we're talking about maybe 50 people short right now, optimally, is what you're saying?
Yes.
I got the impression last week.
It is, but I have to add that Mr. Kubitschek is, I think, at around 14% vacancy rate on train operators, and so... You know, if we had more people,
it's a combined number, not just.
It is really a combined number.
So maybe it's not as a problem in the busing area.
It's not the biggest problem.
Big a problem.
Right.
Now, let me correct that.
Yeah, I'm just trying to clarify.
No, it's a big problem because the bus operators are the feeder for everybody else. So when Dave Kubitschek wants to draw to fill his vacancies, he's drawing from that pool. So it prevents him. So it really gets back to the bus operators being the critical point, because they serve as the feeders for everything else. So we may be holding back on taking bus operators, but it's affecting the rail operators.
That's important. That distinction is important to bring
It's a big balancing act, and you know, our goal is to try to have sufficient folks so that Dave can get the people that he needs, and you know, we're pushing back against that transfer and his need to fill classes at this time.
I'd be interested, not right today, but at some point, some estimates from other systems and what their benchmark is, or national benchmarks in those numbers.
Okay.
Mr. McKay.
Yeah, I want to follow up on that question with two points. One, help me understand the workforce shortage. Is it limited to operators, or are we talking about mechanics, bus supervisors? I mean, there's a lot of people that could cause bus on-time performance to fail, not just the lack of operators. Are you short? When you say workforce shortage, are you expanding beyond operators that the board needs to be aware of?
Well, I'll say this, that our street supervisory ranks, we have 138 budgeted, and right now we are approximately 5 short, and we just hired 4 more. So as far as our street supervisory ranks go, we're right up to snuff in the field. One of the things we are doing is we are recutting their work assignments. We've just spent the last 2 months with their planning folks and our operations folks putting more people on dedicated lines, like the X line or the 16 line, and beefing up our Pentagon coverage. One of the things that we moved away from was visibility on the street, put people into scout cars. So we are going back to more foot patrols, more terminal patrols. We're also putting additional people at some of the hot spots in and around the city. So, you know, by December the 5th, the new supervisory schedule will be in place. So you'll see more people on the street. So to answer that question, we've got enough supervisors on the street. We haven't outpaced our service.
On the maintenance side, I think we're about 50 employees down out of bus maintenance has about 900 employees overall. It's always a challenge. It's a continuing recruitment process to find people that are you know, have the ability to come in and go through the training program and be an active mechanic. It's workable. You know, again, we're, you know, we'd love to be able to reduce the numbers further, but we work with it and continually work with the Human Resource Department to, you know, locate new sources of mechanical assistance.
And that was the second part of my question. As we learned last week, and it was characterized a little bit differently than it is today. I mean, I left with the impression we had a crisis situation last week. But that being said, we didn't approve the management proposal for dealing with the shortfall in operators. And so my question is in, it's only been a week, but I would hope there's a game plan B for stepping up our hiring process. And it may not be a question that you can answer, but I think as a result of our action or non-action last week, the board should be apprised of what is the alternative and how are we still dealing with it. The problem is still there, even though we didn't approve the, I believe it was $750,000. So how are we dealing with that moving forward?
Well, we are coming up. We're working on a plan B. We heard what the board said. They'd rather see us do with internal sources, which means we have to get additional internal resources to do that. I will tell you that when I come to the board, I try to come to the board not the day before we pull buses, but seeing where we're headed, so we don't be in a, we're not in a crisis. But to me, it's a problem, and we have to address it. We have a plan B underway, and we'll get there.
Good. Thank you.
Okay, next slide.
Good.
Okay, on the next slide, we move to looking at industry practices in terms of on-time performance and definitions in particular. So we use the Integrated National Transit Database Analysis System likeness scores, that's the INTDAS, to identify roughly comparable national peer agencies. And as you know, nobody's exactly like us, so we look at who's the most like us. This system, among other things, provides an automated peer selection process that identifies, as I said, comparable transit systems for peer analyses. We also show on-time performance definitions for some of the local transit providers up here. As you can see, agencies often differ in their on-time performance definitions, varying from 0 to 4, or kind of a range of 4 minutes at SEPTA to 2 to 7 minutes, or a range of 9 if you add it all together at Metro and the bus. For all these agencies shown, the early or late minutes refer to scheduled service, with the exception of DC Circulator, which measures headway adherence. So it's important to make that distinction. Everyone has a
sign on that wrong.
I'm sorry?
I think the sign is wrong on that. That should be a greater than, not a less than.
Okay, yeah, sorry for that. Everyone's got a slightly different twist, so this isn't necessarily apples to apples. For example, some of these agencies may include missed or dropped trips and extra trips in their calculation, which is something that Metro does not.
Mr. Jinkle.
Just to clarify for me, I'm not familiar with some of this. The systems, what is CUE or Q and MDT?
Q is Fairfax Cities.
Oh, that's Fairfax City.
City University Express.
MDT is?
Metro Dade.
Okay.
That's one of the
right.
peer transit, non-local. Okay.
And I guess looking at the late number, if we look at our you know, other city systems like SEPTA and MARTA and MTA, if we went to 5 minutes late, our numbers would even be worse.
That's correct. That's correct.
So I guess the question is, how are they doing? You know, what are their percentages? What's their benchmarking for? I mean, are they doing similar to what we're doing, saying 80% is our goal, and how are they doing?
I'm not sure if we have the latest numbers. Ted, do you
know? The only system that I know is Toronto, and Toronto uses a plus and minus 3.
Yeah, but Toronto isn't
it's not on there, but they're – typical.
Okay, that'd be something I'd be interested
in. Yeah, typically they're in around the 65% range.
I think we initially wanted to introduce the idea that people define it differently, then we can look at exactly what, you know, within their definition, what they have achieved in terms of on-time performance. We can present that to you next time.
Mr. Daly?
Yes, pretty much the one. Our window looking at these is about as generous as anybody, so it would be interesting to know, is our good performance relative to the large window or what we're doing.
No doubt that the percentage goes down as the window shortens up, and we'll get some comparisons of how others are doing.
You know, I'll take this opportunity to say one more time, I think our window is not correct. It is too wide. The table here doesn't quite emphasize that, in part by including the circulator, which doesn't really belong there.
Right.
Because that's headway management, which we could be doing on some routes, but we're not.
Right.
And I think that's a good way to run service.
It is.
When you have a high level of service, which I wish we had. But it's not really applicable. And the only other one that you're showing a 7 is in Prince George's County. So, you know, they're they perhaps followed us in the first place, who knows. But, you know, that's not necessarily typical. And 7 minutes late is not on time as far as I'm concerned. I also don't understand how 2 minutes early at a time point, because these are done for specific time checkpoints, not at every stop, I don't know how that ever could be considered to be proper performance.
It isn't. But there are times when the bus is running early. We've, you know, our goal in working, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes, is some of it is schedule, because the operator knows that he's going to run late later, so he tries to run faster in the first part of the route, and we have to, you know.
Okay, so now we're down to one of those realistic schedule
right.
issues.
Mm-hmm.
But the trouble is, if we're saying it's okay, when he's knowingly leaving his stop 2 minutes ahead of what the scheduled time is, then we have a service problem.
I appreciate that.
And so, you know, I understand the reasons this happens, mm-hmm. but I don't like the idea that we don't measure it as having been wrong.
Yeah.
You know, that we're counting it as right. It isn't right. I mean, I'm not even sure I like 1 minute early, but at least that's, you know, somewhat more realistic, but somewhat more reasonable. But to some degree, if it's leaving at all early, that's not adhering to the schedule. If I get there and I have to wait an extra minute, that's one thing. If I get there and the bus is already gone, that's a whole other problem. Again, it does depend somewhat on the frequency of the service. If you're running a route which is, you know, within 12 minutes service, well, then it's not that big a deal, because there's a good chance I'm not even going to look at the schedule.
Right.
I'm just going to go there. On average, you know, the bus is coming pretty often. We don't have very many routes that do that, though. So I think we need to make an adjustment.
Okay.
Anything else on the slide? Not. Go ahead.
I just want to go through the DriveCam system. DriveCam was a contract that we entered into in June of this past year. It's approximately a $3 million contract. We had planned to implement all the cameras and turn them on by December of this year. Happy to report that we're actually at 93 to 95% complete installation on the system. We've also turned on now 7 of the 9 divisions, so we're approximately 45 days ahead of schedule. The system is basically comprised of a smartphone that's positioned in the front of the bus, and then it is triggered by driving forces. Anything that applies a force to the front of the bus, the rear of the bus, or the side of the bus triggers a 12-second clip. The benefit of DriveCam is that these images are saved. They're sent back to us from the call center with coaching notes on. We then take these images and sit down and coach our drivers. And one of the things that I've already determined based on approximately 3 weeks is the statistical information contained in this database is phenomenal. We're already seeing and making adjustments to following too close, not aiming high enough in your steering. The DriveCam system is designed to, as I said, reduce risky driving behavior. It's a preemptive approach to driver education. Drivers over a long period of time develop bad habits. They don't know it. This is an opportunity to sit down with them, show them a video clip, and go through the coaching that they received originally in training, post-training, and it's a positive approach to driver training.
Because you're picking up a problem when there wasn't necessarily any bad outcome.
We right.
have to have an accident.
It could be a near miss, and we're picking up the problem, and we're coaching the employee. What's really great about this system is the statistical information. We know how many events there are, how many events have gone uncoached. We know the effectiveness rate of our coaches. We know how long it's taken them to coach employees. So we're now on the positive side, the proactive side, as opposed to the reactive side to driver training.
I want to understand better. You said, it says at the top, your coming soon installation is 85% completed. Is
it? We're actually up to about 93% completed.
But that means of the fleet?
Of the fleet, of the 1,500 buses.
But are they already running on some of these buses?
They're already run on 7 bus divisions. We have 2 more bus divisions to turn on.
Okay, so because it said coming soon, and I wasn't sure what that meant.
Yeah, when this slide was prepared, was probably 85%, but okay. we've accelerated.
So we're already up and running.
We're up and running.
Within a matter of weeks?
Oh, yeah. Literally, we're going to turn on Landover Division probably next week and Southern Division by Thanksgiving, and we'll be completed.
It'll be 100%.
It'll be 100%. And we had planned on doing that late December, so it's ahead of schedule.
Good. And it really is, if I can add, just from a training standpoint, I get, we've set it up so different categories get different, I mean, a number of different clips. So I get it, say 10 or 12 clips a day. I mean, the things that I'm seeing are operators maybe driving with one hand, drivers who have don't have good posture, drivers just looking straight ahead and not watching left and right. So it's just it's the little things that, you know, it's like defensive driving. You don't really learn anything, but you get reminded about everything that you should have been doing when you're driving a car. So these are good coaching tools. Now, it's going to show some of the, you know, supportive of operators. If a passenger falls out of the seat because some car pulled in front of him and he brakes hard, we'll see that. If there's an incident or an accident, we're going to see that. But the primary goal is to get the operators to look at these clips and just remind them of the techniques that they're using need to be improved upon, and to remind them of some of the things that they're doing that are not meeting regulations or not the best driving habits. And we believe, as a result of this, accidents should go down, workman's comp claims should go down. And so we're working with the union, we're working with our employees, and working with our management people to make sure that we know what we're seeing and what to do with it, and try to use it in the most positive approach possible.
The other thing I just want to touch on with Jack is people tend to look at this as we're catching people doing some things bad, but we're catching a lot of people doing great things out there. And part of the Drive Cam program is the positive reinforcement, and we make sure that they're brought in and congratulated for doing the right thing out there. And they're presented certificates, drive camming certificate, because we want to spread that attitude.
So the goal isn't to be punitive, but
exactly.
To be corrective.
Corrective.
Yeah. Mr. Jinkola.
Yeah, I really support this initiative. It's a really good system. I've heard about it in other locations, and certainly commend you for pursuing this. The staffing required to maintain the system, has that already been incorporated in our budgets and from previous years, or is this some new item we're going to see in future years? And, of course, the beauty of Drive Cam, it also focuses where additional training of drivers is needed, and, of course, that involves additional training. Right. And are you also looking at that element as well? And I'm just more concerned about it. Have we adequately budgeted for the maintenance of this system?
When we purchased the system, it includes a full maintenance of the system and monitoring of the system for 2 years. So what DriveCam, if there's some issue, they will check cameras. If we have a problem with the camera, we call DriveCam. They'll come in and replace it or modify it or whatever needs to be done. Plus, they're doing the monitoring. They get the clips during the day. They monitor the clips, and they give us a report back, warning us of, you know, a good activity or a bad activity as a result of what they see, and then they send it to us directly. So the things that happened yesterday are on our desk or on our computer first thing in the morning. So we have that service that's a part of the budget for the first 2 years.
2 years, what happens?
Come 13, we're going to have to put in a number for the service contract to maintain the service.
All right. And is there any anticipated use of route supervisors as our own staff to look at these reports? Or, I mean, who's actually looking at the reports?
Well, our supervisors are seeing these, and our training staff is looking at this, plus the management staff in the garages. So we have all levels looking at these clips.
I think it's pretty important to incorporate the route supervisors in this.
Absolutely. Process. No, we want them to share this, especially the good things that they're seeing out there with their operators, to keep that communication level part of a safety conversation going on with them.
Just the other thing is that this is just not an operator. It's also for the service people and maintenance. As soon as they get on board the bus, they can be captured in DriveCam. Next slide. It's a hard slide to see, but this is a beta project. This is a brand new project that we've implemented with our customer service team and our IT team. And this is it goes to controllable and uncontrollable delays. One of the things that Mr. Zimmern, you said correctly, we don't have a good statistical background on controllable and uncontrollable delays. What this does, it incorporates existing software technology, our Maximo system, our BLCC, our street supervisors. And the first time we're able to start plotting delays on routes. For instance, if we have a delay on a particular route due to paving, if the supervisor calls that in, we can record detailed information about where the delay was, how long the delay was, what the reason for the delay. Where that's beneficial is for our customer service folks, Lindy Castile's group, is to, when they get a call from a customer, they can click on this, pull it up, and they'll have live, real-time information as to what's going on a particular route and the reason for the delay to service. As I said, we've incorporated existing technologies. We've started to mine that information and use new software to pull it all together. And we're about to expand the use of this through our new BOCC center at Carmen Turner. But for the first time, we'll be able to provide the jurisdiction some statistical information on controllable, uncontrollable delays to service, and we've never been able to do that before.
Next slide. Following up on actions to improve performance, we've been applying some resources towards this over the last couple months. We have a group internally. It's a group of senior managers, cross-functional team. We call the G30, which kind of stands for a group of 30, shortened to G30. And they look at different issues facing the organization, particularly facing operations and their and additional resources, as I said. So one of the groups within G30 formed to conduct an assessment of Metrobus service reliability, including identifying internal and external factors affecting service, and to make some recommendations for improvement, which Mr. Reckle will share shortly. So you have on the slide in front of you some of the elements of their work, including looking at the importance of service reliability to customers. So if you look at the graph to the left, it's a little bit hard to see, but hopefully you can see on your charts in front of you, that on-time performance accounts for 35% of total bus complaints. And then you can see it further broken down with the green line being no-shows, so the green line being kind of the most problematic to customers and resulting in the most complaints. Red being late buses and blue being early. I think it makes sense. It makes logical sense when you look at that. The graph to the right shows the percentage of on-time performance by time period. And an interesting finding from the analysis that the G30 did was that service is more reliable at the beginning of the week and then drops as the week progresses. Additionally, and perhaps more importantly, service reliability varies greatly by the time of day. So in the AM, on-time performance consistently meets the 80% on-time performance target, but in the PM peak and evening, the on-time performance drops considerably, and we're not meeting our targets at that point. Turn it over to Jack. Okay. The next slide.
So as a result of the G30, working with us, and most of these people of the group are not non-bus people, so we kind of get some fresh eyes on things. Some of the things they've suggested as part of their review with us is to implement dedicated bus lanes and intersection treatments to alleviate the impact of traffic congestion. We're aware that these are things that can help. I think the Tiger Grant that the Metro was awarded and the region was awarded is an effort. Once that funding comes in, the jurisdictions will be looking at ways to support bus operations, not just our own, but the other systems in the region to try to speed things along and make service more reliable and running times more consistent. Mr. Harris mentioned that we're redeploying our service operations managers, trying to provide more street time, more visibility time, not only observing bus operations, but route issues on the routes, chuck holes, traffic light issues, lighting issues, whatever we can to try to make the customer's service more responsive and more reliable. As we look at routes and work with the jurisdictions, we're certainly going to look at consolidating bus stops, which means eliminate. We have situations where the bus stops almost every block, and we want to look at reducing some of the stops to try to speed up the service. Review time point locations, adjust schedules, are things that we're talking about earlier about on-time performance and the need to adjust the running times that have been in existence for a considerable period of time. And again, we'll commit to coming back to you with some recommendations on that in the FY12 budget. And communicating more with operators. I think the group spent a lot of time with bus operators. We spend time with operators, but I think this fresh set of eyes saw some different things that we didn't see, and so we need to continue to get the input. They're out there. They know what they're seeing. Situations are different in the morning, different at night, different on weekends, and we need all that input so we can incorporate that into scheduled adjustments.
So should we anticipate that, these are a set of, as you say, sample strategies. Mm-hmm. Should we anticipate a plan that will be implemented incorporating all of these?
Yes, I think so. The Tiger Grant was a grant that provides funding and resources to make some of these adjustments that are talked about along bus lanes and intersection improvements, queue jumping, signal priority, these type of things. We're hoping that the jurisdictions will all be on board to try to make those kind of improvements.
But what I'm asking is, are you going to be presenting something? Is there some way in which that question will be put?
We may be coming back to you. I'm not sure. The funding has not come through yet on the Tiger Grant. It's still in the process of being received. And I think as the jurisdictions get together, maybe action plans that we need to bring back to you to many of these actions will be the result taking place within the jurisdictions.
Yeah, okay. I don't think the plan should be dependent upon the availability of funding. I think
right.
The plan should be the plan, and then we should decide whether or not we're going to fund it.
Okay.
And, you know, some of these are the first one that you're referring mm-hmm. to here, of course, involves other jurisdictions.
Right.
Therefore, we don't completely control it. But on the other hand, if we don't put it on the table, it's never going to happen. Other things in here are within your organization.
Right.
For instance, the last item you're talking about, your communications with mm-hmm. operators. So I might imagine that you'd have a plan that had stuff you're going to do because you can do it.
Right.
Things that you could do here if the board, you know, puts it in a budget, and therefore I'd expect a budget
yeah.
proposal. And then there are other things that are outside the organization for which I'd expect, you know, we make some kind of proposal formally to try and get their cooperation.
Well, we're certainly going to try to do as much as we can without budget issues. Safety conversations, the drive cam conversations are going to give us more opportunities to hear about what's going on out on the street. So I think we're going to get more and more input. I think the safety the drive cam certainly gives us visual recognition of things that are going on. So I think those are things that we'll be doing internally.
And this certainly isn't the first or even the 100th time we've seen consolidate bus types, review time, point locations, and adjust schedules on, you know, presentations
right.
and things you look at on bus. So I'm just trying to get an idea of, should I expect from this that there's actually a plan coming that says, well, having looked at it, here's the things we're proposing to do on the following lines over this timetable or anything like that?
You will get a plan like that. There will be a plan.
Okay. Thanks.
The next page is... Again, the board is fully aware of priority corridor networks. You know, we've got 24 corridors. 50% or more of our ridership are in these corridors. We're working hard to get those implemented. We've had a number that have already been implemented. We're trying to implement more. We've talked about the X service that we will go into effect in December. And there's service evaluation projects to evaluate existing service and recommend operating adjustments. Again, those are all part of budgetary items in many cases so that we can try to improve efficiency, try to improve on-time performance, try to improve fare box recovery. We are addressing, you know, a comprehensive implementation plans, all work with safety and security practices, customer facilities, everything that we can do with jurisdictions and to improve the atmosphere along the bus route and trying to improve all of the processes and technologies that make that trip for the customer that much better. Andrea?
So in summary, I'd like to say that the Performance Office continues to collaborate with the frontline operating groups as well as administrative groups within WMATA to promote a performance management approach to managing our business. We're completing what we call internally execution plans, also known in the business world as business plans, with each key department at Metro, and those business plans include key actions that the department's taking to support WMATA's corporate objectives and goals, performance measures, targets, and identifying who's accountable for the desired outcomes. We also continue to look for and adopt best practices in performance management from the local jurisdictions as well as in the transit industry. And we appreciate you listening to our presentation today. Any questions?
Sure. Mr. Benjamin.
I appreciate particularly the last part of this discussion in terms of the fact that there was always a danger that we were going to create a data collection process that got all sorts of interesting information that got presented and that was the end of it. But it's very clear that one of the things that you're doing is saying, okay, how do we fix problems? How do we improve our service? How do we make all of this better? And putting together teams of people who, in fact, have a vested interest in doing it and some who are just out there dedicated to Metro and may not have a direct vested interest but will bring new ideas. I think this last part of it, developing the execution plans and, in fact, implementing those is really critical, and I'm very pleased to see how you're going ahead with it.
Thank you.
I think that Mr. Benjamin is right on target. We've, for many years, not just in WMATA, but in other agencies, other governments, talked for a lot of years about the need for performance measurement and all that kind of thing, talked a lot about using technology and data gathering, all that. And much of that has been promising, but what we haven't successfully done to the degree I think we need to here or anywhere else, really, is to tie that to actually executing plans to affect performance. And this, to me, is the most promising thing I've seen in what I'm hearing about what you're doing. So I'm very encouraged, and I appreciate the report. I would say, also don't think we're there yet, and I, you know, you're not claiming that. But there are clearly are some big steps to be taken here to follow through on this to actually, you know, afterwards we'll have to evaluate how we did with this evaluation, too, and whether, in fact, we're successful in using these as tools to improve performance. And I'm encouraged, but, you know, also a little cautious just because, you know, we got to see that this actually does work over time. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We'll move to item B, rail-based mileage asset management.
Okay. Mr. Zimmer, I'll be doing the presentation. We were requested to come back to the committee to kind of further expand upon this project. So first slide, basically, and it has something that was already adopted in our FY 2011 plan of contracts. Please go forward. Okay. What we're looking here is basically to start actually working on more accurate data. At this point in time, presently what happens with our mileage is it's basically subject to human error, possibly. There's a lot of algorithms. It's not an exact measurement tool at this point in time. Not to say that what we have is inaccurate, but as we continue to move forward and grow, we're looking for us to become more cost-effective, we definitely need to change our practices a little bit. The other component that is a major area is that our maintenance activities are based off of time-based intervals. And so whenever you're trying to judge that, you're trying to develop maintenance plans that meet FTA standards or local standards, it's really, really difficult to maximize the life of the asset whenever you have all the different configurations, which we do. If we have the ability to measure those units in a real-time application, it makes it much more easier for us to forecast. Next slide, please.
Mr. Kubitschek, to put it sort of briefly, the last presentation we were looking at all these different measures, and this is in effect one particular item you measure.
Yes, sir.
You're going to go about measuring differently.
Yes.
Under this plan.
That is correct.
On a very specific thing, and basically it's the difference between going by essentially sort of time and service as opposed to a real measure of how many miles that a rail cars actually get.
Absolutely. We're really focusing on when we switch over to a mileage-based application, it's really about pinpoint accuracy. We can honestly say that instead of maybe doing an overhaul every 20 months and you really don't have really good collective data on how the wear and everything else is taking place, you can actually start developing programs to say, we know that we need to be rebuilding this thing at 100,000 miles or 150,000 miles. And the other component, just to kind of shorten down, I guess, the presentation, is this. Having a time-based system, once we present it by and to comply with FTA standards, you say you have to do it every 30 days. You have to do it every 30 days. We could have an asset that sits there for 29 days, and if we fail to go through that entire asset, then we get dinged. If we go off of a mileage-based application, if the asset, you know, sits for a couple of weeks or whatever, it really the maintenance cycle is really driven off of its mileage interval, not time. And there's a lot of savings whenever you start compacting all of the systems in there.
So it's somewhat like I have a car, you have a car, we have the same car we both bought in 2005, but maybe mine has 50,000 miles and yours has 100,000 miles. And we wouldn't want to treat them exactly the same in terms of their maintenance needs.
That is also correct. It gives us the flexibility as the asset changes or also based on the level of technology that's on the system because, you know, sometimes the less we touch stuff, the better off we are. Okay. I guess go ahead and flip over to the asset component of this. Next slide, yes. Also tied in with this is an asset management configuration model. Not only will we be able to start, you know, garnering real mileage, you know, from our rolling stock, but there's an asset configuration that not only will we be able to start kind of barcode scanning and tracking the specific rail car and or its major subcomponents, but we're also going to be looking at our storerooms and everything else as well. That's part of this, which is a huge area. Instead of us having to do manual counts all the time, we'll be able to introduce ourselves with the rest of the 21st century to start barcode scanning whenever we get shipment, and it'll also eliminate a lot of manual processes where our financial systems will have real-time data whenever stuff was delivered, where it's actually at, and it's just a lot more efficient for us, and it'll save a lot of redundant manual processes, as well as we'll be able to go out into the system, for example, facilities or buses or rail cars, whenever we have to really do a large FTA audit, we'll be able to scan those things really quick. And it just improves our database, substations, maybe pumps that we're required to count on, and, as well as a potential platform to work and do data from the field environment as well. Next slide, please. Okay, this gives you basically the overall project cost of this. Again, we tried to cover the points of, you know, about the importance of the mileage base, the asset configuration, the mobile Maximo, again, that's for inventory counting. The infrastructure upgrades at the yards and such, the nice thing about this is that basically the Maximo system already has the capability of doing this without any special additions. And since we operate our equipment on rail and stuff, we can pretty much distinguish. We know where equipment has to enter and exit without a bunch of excess investment. This kind of gives you an outline of the overall schedule, where we're at, where we're starting, our milestones and stuff as we're moving forward. The other thing that I'd also like to say is that we've also been very conscientious, say, for instance, the 1000 series, it's scheduled for replacement and stuff. When you look at the schedule, we're not going to waste our time or our resources in trying to put that technology and stuff in there at that point in time since they're scheduled to start being replaced and stuff. So we were also trying to be very efficient with what funds that we have, you know, available at this time.
So does the June 2014 reflect the delivery schedule for the 7000 series?
The nice thing about it, the 7000 series will show up wired and ready to go.
Because they'll be done on the line.
Yes. The lead time will be modifying the 2s, 3s, 5s, 6s, or remaining fleets to put the technology inside it to transmit the mileage-based information. But the 7Ks, the network will already be up, and the 7Ks off of that will be able to transmit. And we did touch a little bit in here that even on diagnostics and everything else with this LAN network, the size, the capability of it, we'll actually be able to pull out some technical information or status of cars as they pull in or entry or exit stations that could alert our people in our yards or, you know, people on the alignment and stuff. So the platform, and we are planning for the future, and it's very good, reliable technology.
The only question I have on this is, it's an $8 million project. Do you estimate that the changes in maintenance schedule that you're saying it makes possible are going to save more than the present discounted value of $8 million?
I believe that there will definitely be a return on this investment of $8 million, no problem. And it's hard to forecast it, you know, at this point in time. But whenever you factor in the amount of wear components, like we have friction rings and brake pads and wheel sets and everything else, it's an investment for our future in the right direction.
Because
and we'll be able to quantify.
You to reduce what you say is unnecessary.
That is correct. And also the other component is our labor. As we, you know, we're looking to make sure that we maximize all of our resources. The less that we have to bring in a rail car based on its equipment platform, it basically means the less people that you need around the asset on an operational level.
All right. Any other questions on this matter? Thanks very much.
Okay.
I'll move to the final item.
Okay. With this one right in here, Ms. Richardson will be supporting us. We'll be doing a joint presentation on this.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Dave and I are partnering on a customer involvement process that I wanted to walk you through. We are in the putting together final details on it, but I think it's important to show you the process that we're going through and our objectives. And this is a question I think that came up at the board meeting, so we put it together for you. So the overall strategy is to make sure to gather inputs, opinions, and feedback for a variety of customer groups. first and foremost to, you know, incorporate safety and security advancements, the most safe technology and amenities that we can have in the cars, to also meet customer requirements, the most up-to-date requirements that they have in the current marketplace, and to reflect their amenity preferences. What we're talking about are the interiors and the customer amenities inside. But also, and another customer base for us is our own employees, and to ensure that we're providing safe and efficient and comfortable working environment for them in the new cars. To also meet the ADA requirements, make sure that maneuverability issues are addressed, sight issues are addressed, and other features are incorporated. To also look at the maintenance standards and make sure that they're maintainable, that we select amenities and materials, et cetera, that are easily maintained, that don't cause extra costs along the way, and also problems with the maintenance force. And overall, to project a forward-looking 21st century transit car, this is the nation's capital, and our design for the cars, the interiors of the design, should reflect our customer base and what they want. And it should be one in which the nation should be proud to see. So it's very aspirational. That's where we're going. So just a little bit of a look back over time.
Very little, please.
Pardon?
Very little.
Very little?
Brief.
Briefly look back? Okay. Briefly look back. It has evolved over time.
Several of us have done it.
Pardon me?
Several of us were there for the
history. Okay, so let me just say that the process has evolved over time to increasingly include customer, employee feedback and involvement in the process, so that in this last round, when the spec was put together, the specification for the new cars, there was quite a bit of input already included into the specification. So very briefly, on the information that was included, the feedback came from customers primarily on our committee groups of the Riders Advisory Committee, the Accessibility Committee, the amenities that were looked at, you can see there for yourselves. But we also did some facilitated meetings at Greenbelt and some of the yards also. On the next page, you can see that we looked at passenger flows, cameras were installed along the way, the police department was involved on the security enhancements and some of the features that came from their involvement, and also our own maintenance departments and operations departments were involved. So going forward, what we want to do is evolve to what is a standard industrial design process, really.
Mr. Sure. Mm-hmm. Dan.
When you said maintenance and operations department were involved, was that down to the workforce level?
That is correct. We had frontline input. Absolutely. And then they are still part of the process. And then the other component, as we go through the, say, for instance, the verification or validation of some of these forms and designs, like we'll actually have operators that will actually, you know, say, yes, this is acceptable, no, it's not. And we can also say that on the maintenance side of the selection of the 7K process, we actually had a maintenance staff that was on the selection criteria, which was the first time here. So we've got really tried to get really good stakeholder buy-in from day one. So they are definitely involved.
Let me ask you, since, I mean, I didn't need an extensive report on the things done before since I was here. You weren't, so I'm glad you reviewed them. But my question is, which I don't, isn't clear from this, are you going to be using any of that stuff?
Yes. Yes.
So all the data that was collected, for instance, on those cars in which cameras were placed to study flow and all that?
Yes. What happens is it's an evolutionary process, really. You take your you take the designs or the specification, you go through three different design stages. You have the conceptual design, which is sort of your drawing stage. You begin to place things. You begin to look at the inside of the shell. You look at preferences of types of materials. So the structure and the beginning point of all the input made it possible to have the starting point for the specification, which along the way you continue to validate. You gain more information, you select more materials, you get more preferences, you further design from concept to the preliminary design stage to the final design stage, and you have to constantly come back and validate and get more information because
You want to make sure that you're on target with what you heard, but also there may be some things we can't do that we hear, and we need to do the best that we can. So in general, that's what happens, and what we want to do is go back to these various groups to constantly get the feedback from them and input. So from employees, we have working groups, the train operators.
This is what's described on slide 43.
Pardon me?
This is what you're just talking about is what's
referred to in
slide 43.
Very quickly. Yeah. Right. Sure. And so, I'm sorry.
Mr. Manchin.
I was struck. One of the issues that I find difficult that you're going to, I presume, find difficult also is when you talked about customer groups and what customer groups want. Mm-hmm. I was very, very surprised by the recommendations made by the RAC because they reflect typically people who ride during the peak and do short rides.
That's right.
People who live, you know, fairly close to the core and are traveling when the trains are very, very crowded. Those people want the maximum number of doors, the minimum number of seats. For the people who ride in the off-peak and for the people who do the longest ride, they tend to want many more seats, and they're willing to sacrifice doors for loading and unloading in order to be able to sit down. So one of the challenges I think you're going to have is what is the balance of people that we are looking at and asking as we go through this, and considering that our cars get used in such a way that the person who's going on the very long ride from Vienna has got to be accommodated and isn't going to want to ride if they've got to stand all the way from Vienna, has got to be balanced with the person who in Boston can't get on. Mm-hmm. And all the people who have to worry about how long it takes to get everybody off the car when there are the number of doors there are. So I would be very cautious as you choose your groups for focus groups and get customer input, and I was very surprised by what the RAC said, that it appeared to be only one group that was talking, and that's going to be a challenge for you.
I was pleased that you had the AAC, mm-hmm. because it's not only the fact that how long you ride, it's your capacity to want to sit, and I think we are talking about paratransit, and I would include the population of seniors. You know, people want to use this service, but there is a demographic that is very broad, and we have to balance both of those. You're exactly right about the long-distance rider versus those that are short and the conflicts that go with that. But if we want to make our services more available to that large demographic that we say sometimes drives the cost because they choose the next alternative, which is our paratransit, we really do have to take into consideration the services in terms of accessing and the comfort that comes in this ride, because otherwise we find people who make other choices that are more costly to use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as someone who is not tall challenged, I want to point out that was a joke, but I guess okay. I have to stand a lot on Metro Rail during rush hours, and I really need to make a point here about the location of the metal and or plastic strap hangers. You know, I know that why they can't be in front of the doors, but there is a section of horizontal piping that it seems to, they're not on the other side of the doors, you know, going into the car. It doesn't seem to have available straps, which are the areas people stand. So for someone who's inside the car in front of one of the seated areas, you can always hold onto the seat rail. And I see very few of the metal strap hangers being used at all, as well as when I do see the plastic ones are not being used there as well. They're more needed where the area where people stand. And I know there is some criteria about how close they are to the door, but I see so many cars where there's none there. They're all in the inside where the seats are, not in that last section of horizontal piping and the ceiling, where, in fact, you probably could put them, and they should be. So I would like you to look at the new cars, but also look at the current cars that we have out there to make those kind of adjustments, if we can. I just really want to know what is the criteria for the location of those, because I see the ones where the seats are not being used.
Well, this is slightly off topic. Let me
say, right.
Because I agree strongly with Mr. Giancola's point, and I've tried to raise that in the past, that, you know, this is really about the 6000 series more than anything else, because they're the ones that have the metal handles. that could accommodate them. But they're also the ones that have a number of the other improvements. So there are more vertical bars connecting to seats as you go in. So there's a lot of those, precisely where you have the handles, which is a part of the reason for, I think, Mr. Giancola's observation. There's just a lot of options once you get in there. But when you're in front of it, in the open area, you don't have the handles precisely where you most need them. So let me second his point and ask if that can be looked into, because it does seem like repositioning some of those on our 6,000 series cars and perhaps repositioning some of the vinyl straps on the earlier cars could provide a benefit. I know there's a concern with those who have a different altitudinal problem than Mr. Giancola and myself, such as Mr. Kubitschek, and we do have to be careful that we don't have too much difficulty with him and others bopping their heads.
I have a problem with the doorway.
You can't fix that one.
Yeah. Again, about balancing needs. But
as I pointed out when I first advocated for, you know, for such handles, you know, I happen to be just about median height for the American male. And the American female is as a lower at median height. That means that probably a significant number, more than half of people, are shorter than me. And if I have difficulty at times reaching the thing, then probably more than half the riders do, just based on simple arithmetic. So I think that we've done a little better in recent years providing some options, but we definitely could modify what we're doing, I think. And I think some tuning might be called for. So I would just like to second Mr. Giancola's request.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Benjamin.
One of the interesting things is to watch as we evolve through this process, because I remember the discussion, and you probably do too, about the 6,000 series cars. And part of the design process was deliberately to make it difficult to stand anywhere near the doors. And therefore, all of those things were moved away from the doors, and there was no way to hang on. And we have this very large space where we've made it difficult for people to hang on. The problem is that they do anyway. And they end up in that area, and so the question is, how do you encourage people to move farther into the car but still provide the possibility for them to be safe and secure when they are near the doors? And nobody's come up with a good answer for that one yet.
See, I think there is. I think we have to make a distinction. The big change with the 6,000 was not having the poles right there in the middle. And that definitely has a benefit. It's not only that it lets people, you know, encourages people to move into the car because they're looking for something to hold on to. It's that you don't have a knot of people blocking you from the doorway. And the biggest obstacle to, you know, when you're on the train, as you know as a rider, from being in, is the fear you're not going to be able to get to your door. Many of us have that situation where our stop is up and it, you know, it's hard to get there as quickly as the doors move. So, you know, taking out that obstruction, I think, was important. It's also, you know, difficult, lots of people trying to hang in onto the one vertical bar on your side. By moving that out, we definitely improved flow and probably increased the capacity of the car as a practical matter. But if we do what Mr. Giancola was talking about, I think we'll make it easier for people to stand in that area where we actually do want to use that space, but they won't be knotted up, you know, the way they were around a pole if you have a few handles along either side, because on the 6,000 series cars, of course, we have the, you know, the overhead bar running on either side, which is part of why this can work. It's part of the difficulty in the earlier series cars. But you actually still have people opened up more. I think just the layout of, you know, kind of the pattern of where people will tend to group will be better nonetheless than the earlier series with the vertical pole.
I guess I was just trying to say it's always a balance, and no matter which way we do it, there's one passenger group that's disadvantaged or flow is somehow impeded, and that balance is a difficult one and one that we all have to keep looking at.
I think that's right. And that's what I said. I think it's a little bit of fine-tuning. I think, you know, can move this back on the dial a little bit the other way and maybe get an improvement.
Can I just speak to that a little bit, very briefly? Part of the process here, aside from getting the input of all the stakeholders, is how you then take all that input and balance all those concerns that you've done. And what we're trying to do as part of this process is this is really brought together by experts. I mean, we could, as a committee, can come up with something, but I'd like to have experts who are experienced in product development, and that's what they do, is they take all the customer and stakeholder inputs and put into the best design that they can for this. Well, the car builders are, you know, required to have such a person, but they also have their own agenda. So as part of this process, we also retain our own industrial designer with experience in this area as we have that dialogue and debate and input, which doesn't give you the perfect solution, but will help hone it, fine-tune it so that people, when they see it, will at least feel there's a lot of thought that's gone into it.
Is that the design advocate that's
yes.
referred to?
Yes.
So that's an outside consultant
yes.
that we pay to represent
yes.
us to ensure we're getting.
Yes.
Yeah. Very good. All right. And that's the schedule.
Yes. So right now our team, Dave's team, is working with Kawasaki at the conceptual stage. And when we get the conceptual work together, that's when we go out for the customer feedback. And then the cycle is the feedback comes in, go into another design cycle, comes back out, comes back to, you know, more feedback, and goes on. So it's a you know, we take it all in. You know, we do balancing. We work with what we can. We try to reflect what we heard, and then they validate. They'll come back at the design stages and validate. And as the general manager said, we will be led by someone who is experienced in this area and will be our advocate in the design process. So that's where we are.
That's good. Sounds like the right way to proceed. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think that concludes our agenda for today.